This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Dead End Street by Sheila Conley, narrated by Marguerite Gavin. Chapter 1. The wind scoured my face as I walked briskly from Suburban Station across City Hall Plaza toward the Pennsylvania Antiquarian Society, where I worked. Where I was president and responsible for seeing that my 40-plus employees worked. Where it was hard for anybody to work since construction was still going on, construction that had begun a couple of months earlier, when the society had received a generous grant from a grateful patron, whom I'd kind of helped out when a dead body was holding up his mega-construction project in the suburbs. It was a wonderful gift, but the resulting construction process had produced a lot of noise, dust, and disgruntled society members. I was hoping, praying, that it would be finished by the end of the year, only a month or so away, or at least all but the painting, and that would be quiet, wouldn't it? And then, of course, the monumental task of sorting and reshelving all of our treasures, collected over the course of more than a century, would begin. I refused to think about the chaos that would involve. November was always a tricky month for getting back and forth to work. James, my drat, we still hadn't settled on labels for each other. Lover? No, not fit for proper company. Partner? That sounded like a business arrangement, although one could argue that marriage was one as well, with a legal document attached. Boyfriend? No, too high school. Sweetie? Plum dumpling? Cuddle bunny? No, too silly for two mature adults, one of whom was an FBI agent. Special Agent Cuddle Bunny? I snickered. That was so not going to work. And I was a seasoned professional, a member of the Philadelphia cultural community, an historian, a manager, and an independent woman, who happened to be living with a smart, handsome, capable man. We'd bought a house together a couple of months earlier, and were still settling in and getting to know each other. Neither of us had lived with anyone else for a long time, so we were moving cautiously. It had taken us a while just to pick furniture to fill most of the rooms of our gorgeous Victorian in Chestnut Hill, and then we'd mutually decided to take a breather before we tackled the task of choosing wall and window treatments. Thank heaven the kitchen had been modernized before we'd bought the place, or we might have found ourselves living on takeout and microwave meals. We often commuted together into the city by car, but on this particular morning, Special Agent James Morrison had an early meeting elsewhere. So I took the train rather than drive. I liked riding the train to the city because it gave me time to read the newspaper and the stack of magazines that kept accumulating. The only problem was when I had to walk from the train station to the society building during the colder months. Luckily, there were underground passages that would take me right to the building, but using the passages signaled the end of summer and the beginning of the cold season, which I was reluctant to accept. At least I'd had the foresight to haul out my warm coat. It would have been handy if I had found my gloves. I made a mental note to look for them when I got home. I arrived at the society building nice and early. One of the pluses of walking was that I could approach from Broad Street and admire the building's solid brick walls and imposing bluestone pillars. It had been built to last, and to protect the collections it sheltered, more than a century before. I had been relieved when the architects involved in the renovation had declared it structurally sound and fit to weather another century. It was the interior storage for collections that had fallen behind the times, and the roof, and the heating and ventilation, but we had money in the bank and a good crew, and all would be remedied shortly. I greeted Bob, who stood watch over our front desk. He was a retired police officer and provided a reassuring presence, then took the elevator up to my office on the third floor, which housed the administrative offices. My assistant, Eric, was already at his desk. We vied in a friendly way to see who could arrive first, because when he started working for me, nearly 2 years earlier, whoever arrived first had to make the coffee. Now we had a sparkly new single-serve coffee system in the break room we all shared, and it did make decent coffee. But I had to admit I kind of missed the old system. the uncertainty about whether the pot waiting would be fresh or ancient, and whether you would exhaust the contents and feel compelled to brew the new pot, which took time. Modern technology did make life simpler, but it changed other things, too. Good morning, Eric. What's on the agenda for today? I was not a scatterbrain, but it could be a challenge to keep appointments straight in my head. Eric flipped through his notebook. I would have said it looked like a free day, but you just got a call from someone who works with the city who wants to meet with you ASAP. I penciled them in, but I can cancel if you'd prefer. Eric looked at me anxiously. He was relatively young, from the South, and very polite, and very grateful to have the job, since his work history was patchy at best. I'd hired him on gut instinct, and he hadn't let me down. If I don't have anything else scheduled, I might as well go ahead and see them. Did the person say what this was about? No, ma'am. Just that it was a matter that had to do with the society, and they needed to resolve it sooner rather than later. City government. Everything always had to be done immediately. Except then you had to wait 6 months for the paperwork to clear. When should I expect them? Any minute now. You want I should get you some coffee first? Why don't I wait and see if our guests want anything? You can go down and escort them up here when they arrive. Yes, ma'am. I went into my office and hung up my coat, neatly, on a hanger. I really liked my office, although I felt I didn't belong in it. It was on the corner of the building, so it had decent views and plenty of light. It was furnished with some very nice antiques from the society's collections, which scared me to death. I was always worried that I'd spill food or something worse on a priceless piece. But I had to admit they looked extremely handsome, and they certainly impressed visitors. The more mundane items, like a computer printer and files, were discreetly concealed in modern mahogany cabinets. Best of all, it was always clean and neat, a haven of peace in the midst of what could be a chaotic job, which for reasons that continued to mystify me had included solving more than one murder. I had to admit I'd closed my door and hidden out my office now and then just to find some peace. I busied myself clearing off some items of business Eric had left on my desk, and it was only a few minutes later that he announced he was going downstairs to escort the visitors to our meeting. That was one of the few stabs at security my earlier predecessors had made. Researchers were not allowed to wander at will throughout the building. Some stacks were open for them to use. Unique, rare, or valuable materials were housed in closed stacks, and the researchers would have to submit a request and wait for a librarian or assistant to retrieve what they wanted. The administration areas were strictly off-limits to most people, and one could not get past the second floor without a special key. It didn't exactly stop thieves in their tracks, but it made it a little harder for them to invade spaces where they shouldn't be. Of course, the general public often assumed that we had video cameras watching everyone, but that was far from the truth. Such a setup was on our wish list, but well behind a lot of other items. That kind of security equipment was expensive, plus we'd need someone to actually monitor what was going on, and adding staff was equally expensive. Somehow there was never enough funding to go around. Eric ushered a man and a woman into the office and asked if they wanted coffee. They said yes, so presumably they weren't in my office to complain about something. I looked them over discreetly. Both appeared to be in their 30s, dressed in business casual, and carrying leather portfolios. And both were black. Of course, the society had black employees, but most of our patrons were not. We did hold some significant collections relevant to the city's abolitionist movement, but it would be jumping to conclusions to assume that that was what had brought them here. Researchers didn't usually make appointments with the presidents of institutions. In any case, I didn't recognize either one of them, but that didn't surprise me. I'd had dealings with Philadelphia's government under more than one administration over the years. I'd met the current mayor and respected him, but most of my interactions had been with committee members a lot farther down the management charts. The society didn't have any issues outstanding with the city. We applied for and received an annual grant for cultural institutions in the city, but it was small. Not that any money was too small to welcome in the non-profit sector. We made polite small talk until Eric had delivered the coffee. Then I sat back in my chair and asked, "What can I do for you?" The two exchanged a glance, and the woman nodded to the man. He spoke first.
"My name is Tyrone Blakeney, and I'm head of the North Philadelphia Neighborhood Partnership, which you've probably never heard of."
He smiled pleasantly. "And I'm Cherise Chapman," the woman said quickly. "I work for the city's licenses and inspections department." I still had no clue why they were sitting in front of me. "What brings you to the society?"
"Are you familiar with the funeral for a home project in the city?"
Tyrone began. "Only what I've read in the Inquirer," I said. "Something to do with mourning the last properties in the neighborhoods that have changed radically over time."
"Do you know how many derelict or abandoned properties there are in Philadelphia?"
Cherise demanded. I guessed that they had made this pitch before. I felt like they were ganging up on me, coming at me from two sides, although it wasn't fair to them for me to feel that way. "No, I don't, although I'm guessing there are a lot, based on what I've seen personally." At the very least, I knew that there were some neighborhoods I, as a woman alone, did not want to venture into, even by daylight, with all my car doors securely locked.
"More than 40,000, 40,000,
Cherise said indignantly. She spoke with the fervor of a true believer. "And that's just the abandoned ones. There are many, many more that are falling down, and yet people, families even, are still living in them because they have nowhere else to go." Tyrone gave her a stern look. Apparently she was getting ahead of the script, and Cherise subsided. "I understand that's a problem," I told them. "But what does that have to do with the society?"
"We should take a step backward and explain," Tyrone said. "As she told you, Cherise works for the city in the department that is responsible for inspecting and all too often condemning buildings that are too unsafe to occupy. Ideally, they would be torn down to make room for new units of affordable housing. But I'm sure you can understand that that is often impossible given the city's financial constraints, which is a shame because it means that not only homes are lost, but so are entire historic neighborhoods, the rich diversity that Philadelphia's past offers."
Tyrone clearly cared about this subject, and I was beginning to see a glimmer of light. "You said you were in charge of a partnership. What does that do?"
"The partnership is a non-profit coalition of agencies and individuals, such as real estate developers who are seeking to salvage the old neighborhoods before they are lost forever. By rehabbing whatever buildings are viable and creating new structures that emulate the styles that came before. The ones that once created a sense of community. I'm sure you know what I mean. Triple-decker row houses with porches or front steps where people could sit for an evening and interact with their neighbors. Corner stores that provide the essentials, pocket parks that offer children a safe place to play, not too far from home, daycare, schools, simple restaurants."
I realized I was confronted by a pair of zealots, but I had to admire them for trying. "I love your vision, but how do you make it happen?"
"By using a multi-pronged strategy." Cherise took up the thread eagerly. "The city has the properties on its books and doesn't want them. But we know the legal process is necessary to gain clear title, and we have the clout to follow through. To go after absentee landlords or those people who have walked away, unwilling to pay taxes or maintain the buildings. Tyrone here has the vision to see the possibilities and the connections to the neighborhoods, and the charm to sell it to the people who matter."
"The ones who have the money, you mean?"
Tyrone grinned, which made him look boyish.
"Well, yes. It takes money to make something like this work, but not as much as you'd think. We'd love to be able to use laborers who live in those very neighborhoods, so they have a stake in the outcome. The big chain stores are scared to step up and move in, but we can recruit smaller ones or single shop owners, again, ones who live there, who want to raise families in a place that feels like home. Not a slum with bars on all the windows. Everyone wins."
His enthusiasm was infectious. "Well, I'll tell you up front that we have no money, if that's what you're looking for."
"We know that. You're a non-profit, just like we are. But you have the resources to provide the history of the neighborhoods we're targeting. And before you protest, we aren't going to try to do this all over the city, all at once. That would be a recipe for disaster, spreading ourselves too thin. We want to start with a single showcase neighborhood and do it right. Bring it in on budget, retain the old residents, and attract new ones. Show what can be done. We've got some smart businessmen on board, and they've been crunching the numbers. We've got some journalists, both print and electronic, on our side, so we'll get press attention. But what we need from you is a way to flesh out the story, to show what the place once was, which most living people never knew or have forgotten, which will show them what it could be again.
Without committing myself, I was already mentally reviewing what resources we had in the building, and who might have the time to commit to a project like this, even if it was only part-time, like a day a week. Lisa Penrose would be one possible choice, and when I thought of her, I realized that Elliot Miller could be a real asset, unless he hated the whole idea. I hadn't spent enough time with him to know his philosophy of urban development or redevelopment. Elliot was a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and he was seeing Marty Terwilliger, uber board member of the society, and a tireless cheerleader for those projects she cared about. Elliot had been nominated for a vacant seat on the society's board, and I thought his academic area of expertise, urban planning, would complement the roster of lawyers and business people we already had on the board. In addition to Marty, who brought an encyclopedic knowledge of Philadelphia history, plus three generations of board commitment. If I could get all of them on the same page... I was already building castles in the air when I realized that Tyrone was speaking to me. Excuse me, I got caught up by what you were planning. Could you repeat what you said?
I was saying that we think North Philadelphia is the best neighborhood to start. It's close to Center City, and there's already some interest in turning it around, so we could see substantial results fairly quickly. And you, or rather the society, already has a stake in it.
We do? I said, bewildered. Yes, Cherise said. The society owns a property right in the middle of the neighborhood. Chapter 2. I tried to maintain an intelligent expression while I processed that statement. Nope, that didn't ring a bell. I'm afraid I don't understand, I said. You're saying that the Pennsylvania Antiquarian Society owns a piece of property? I may be wrong, but I was under the impression that the society had divested itself of all property holdings quite a few years ago, long before my tenure here. Cherise gave me a perfunctory smile. If you're familiar with our office, you might be aware that things have been known to fall through the cracks. Your organization may well have sold off its holdings, but it could be that the original property transfer to the society was not recorded correctly. So it was not included in whatever list you had. But when we began looking into this particular neighborhood in more depth, we made a thorough search, and the original record turned up. Ah, I said, I can understand how that might happen. But what is it you want us to do about it? Give it to the city, or to your organization? Sell it to you for a dollar? Other more troubling ideas came bubbling up, like whether we would be responsible for back taxes for who knew how many years, or fines. I can assure you that we were unaware of this oversight. Tyrone hurried to step in, after sending a warning glance at Cherise.
Ms. Pratt, I'm sure we can resolve that question without any penalty. However, the process could take some time, time we don't have. The building you own is in perilous condition and slated for demolition, if it doesn't fall down first. Let me explain, since you aren't familiar with it. It's a single-row house that's lost its row. It's the last of its kind on an entire block, the only survivor of a once-vital part of the neighborhood. As such, it has some symbolic value, and we're planning a couple of public events around it, once we clear up this title business. Kind of a funeral for the building. Since it appears that the society is the owner of record, you have the opportunity to step up and do some good.
I gathered my thoughts. Mr. Blakeney, since this is news to me, I need some time to process this information. Before any decisions can be made, I need to inform our board of the issue and provide them with details. And I have to explore what options we have, and I should probably talk to our lawyer as well. I assume you have a timetable, but we may not be able to meet it. and I probably don't need to tell you that we don't exactly have a lot of money available to us, and much of what we have is restricted to specific uses, so I'm not sure what kind of help you think we can give you.
Call me Tyrone, please. Like I said, we don't expect money, and we don't want to see you penalized for a mistake somebody made decades ago. But I want you to understand that this is a piece of Philadelphia's history. If I understand it right, your institution is charged with preserving that history.
It was very clear that he was passionate about his cause. He had a point, and it hit home. But I couldn't remember any project like this that the Society had taken part in, and I wasn't ready to commit to anything. I agree in principle, Tyrone, but that doesn't mean that I'm in a position to do anything about it, certainly not on such short notice. Surely if you're part of a non-profit organization, you know that. Under normal circumstances, there would be a procedure. We would assess the situation, and if the board approved action, we would most likely engage in a fundraising campaign to raise money to support your efforts. I can see from your perspective that we could be a good ally.
Tyrone reined in his zeal. Miss Pratt, I do understand your position, but we don't have that kind of time. I know that money is tight for everyone. What I'm hoping you can do is help us to generate public awareness of this situation. Your institution has the potential to do immeasurable good. With your archival resources and your membership, we're not asking for money, and the building is beyond salvage. But if our organizations could work together, your efforts could help us to reach a wider audience than we could hope to on our own.
I was pretty sure that our memberships didn't overlap. Was he asking me to share our donor list, or was he trying to lean on the Society as an absentee landlord, even though we hadn't been aware of it? Still, I smiled at him. He was persuasive, and he certainly seemed to be sincere. I appreciate your faith in our clout, but you have to recognize that we're an old organization, and we simply don't move quickly. I need to discuss what role we could play with other people before we make any decisions. The poor man looked deflated. Charisse finally spoke again. Miss Pratt, maybe it would help if you could come see the property and put the problem in perspective. I understand your reservations, and as a city employee, I know that bureaucracies, large or small, can move at a glacial pace. But this particular project has a time limit that was not of our choosing. She glanced at her companion. Would you be willing to come with us and take a look at the site? It won't take more than an hour of your time. It's not far away. Then you can review our documentation and proposals with a clear eye. While I was still not enthusiastic about the idea, I did see her point. When would you want to do this?
Today? This afternoon?
Tyrone had come back to life, seeing a glimmer of hope. Let me check with my assistant who keeps my calendar. I'll be just a moment. I stood and walked to the door, pulling it nearly shut behind me as I approached Eric's desk. What's my afternoon look like? Eric pulled up the calendar on his computer screen.
You don't have anything specific scheduled. Why?
Our guests have invited me to see a decrepit building that the Society owns, in an area of town I'd rather not be in.
Would you like me to give you an excuse not to go?
Eric volunteered, his voice low. I was tempted, but I said, no, I guess not. If they're right and the Society actually does own it, there may be legal issues, and I might as well deal with it now rather than later. Thanks, Eric. I squared my shoulders and returned to my office. It looks as though my schedule is clear for the rest of the day. What do you suggest?
Charisse and Tyrone exchanged glances. We have a meeting at 11, Tyrone said. Why don't we stop by and pick you up at, say, 2?
Obviously, they had no plan to wine and dine me, to win me over. That sounds fine. It will give me a chance to go through our records here and figure out what happened, if I can. Could you give me the address so we can check our files?
Tyrone rattled off an address, and I jotted it down.
Then he and Charisse stood up simultaneously.
Excellent, Tyrone said. We will be here at 2, and we'll take you to the site. I think our plans will be much clearer to you when you can get a sense of the area.
I'll look forward to it.
Not.
See you later, then. We all shook hands, and I escorted my guests out to Eric, who in turn led them to the elevator and downstairs. The whole situation troubled me. I didn't like surprises, not if they involved money and lawyers, which it appeared this one might. I wandered down the hall to chat with my director of development, Shelby Carver. Shelby had joined the society at about the same time as Eric. They were my first hires when I'd been bumped up to the president's office, and she had filled my former job. Shelby was from the South, too, and had proved to be an asset as a fundraiser. She was also smart and observant, which more than made up for her somewhat thin resume. I often used her as a sounding board for some of my ideas. When I rapped on the doorframe, Shelby looked up from the stack of documents she was sorting through and said, "Business or pleasure?" "Development business, I think. You have a moment to talk?" "Anything for you, Madam President," Shelby said with a grin. "Sit." She waved at a chair. I pulled the chair closer to her desk. I just had an odd visit from two people who work for the city, or maybe one person with the city and another with a non-city agency, but they're working together. Anyway, I have been informed that the society owns a building in a blighted portion of the city. I looked like an idiot because I didn't know we owned any real estate, except for the property where we sit. Can you provide any enlightenment? Lady, if you don't know after you put in several years in my job, how the heck am I supposed to know? Well, I didn't know during those years, so now we're even. I will admit that I have some vague memory of a discussion years ago, that in the past a lot of people chose to remember the society in their wills with real estate rather than cold cash. Could be that was their only asset, or maybe they couldn't unload it and figured their generous gesture would look good in their obituary or whatever. Anyway, my visitor said that somehow one, at least, I hope it's only one, transaction didn't get filed properly. So apparently we still own it. And the problem is what? Shelby asked. Can't you just sell it now and be rid of it? Nothing is ever that simple, Shelby, I told her. It's located in an area where I think I'm pretty safe in saying that there is no active market for property sales. That is, a slum. Maybe if these people hadn't tracked me down, the property would have defaulted to the city, and they could do whatever they wanted. But some eagle-eyed researcher found the mix-up, so now we're on the hook for it. What do they want you to do? That's kind of tricky, I think. If I understand it correctly, and mind you, I've spent all of half an hour with these people, they kind of dangled the hope that they would work with us to expedite the legal aspects. If the society would throw its weight behind some kind of neighborhood redevelopment effort? Publicly, you mean? Shelby asked. I think so. Kind of add some prestige to their efforts, and maybe give them some historic ammunition in their efforts to rebuild what was once a fine old neighborhood. Shelby said thoughtfully. Is that a bad thing? I mean, the society would get some visibility, and it would look like we're fulfilling our mandate to preserve local history. They didn't ask for money, did they? I told them flat out that we don't have that kind of money. I guess our only bargaining chip is our standing in the cultural community. What happens if we don't play nice with them? I don't know. Somebody may really want this property to complete a larger lot for some plan we don't even know about, although I don't think anyone will offer to buy it from us. We could give it away to the city or a private developer, if there is one, or to some kind of community organization, but I don't know how the board will feel about that. I can't make an executive decision anyway, so I have to take it to them. If we do nothing, we might get cited and fined for neglecting it. If something were to happen to someone there, we could have some liability. Obviously, I have a lot more questions than answers. Did they tell you that? Shelby asked. Smells a bit like blackmail. I didn't get that feeling from either of them. I think they really are trying to do some good. So why'd you come to me? I know diddly squat about how Philadelphia government works. Shelby hadn't lived in Philadelphia for very long, so that wasn't surprising. I know. I don't either, really. And I've lived here a lot longer than you. What I was thinking is that you could go through the development records and see if there is anything on the original gift. And in addition to that, you could pull what we have about North Philadelphia. I know enough to stay out of the place, Shelby said firmly. Apart from that, That's a job for a researcher. I know. If we move forward with this, which I haven't promised, I was thinking it might be a good project for Lisa. But for now, just see if you can find anything on the property in our files, will you? I'm going to go see it this afternoon, and maybe after that I'll have a better handle on things. Shelby sighed, mostly for effect. All right. I'll check on it. What's the address? 387 Bickley Street, in the city? Shelby wrote a note on a pad. It's not some gorgeous decaying mansion, is it? I'm told it's a row house minus the rest of the row, kind of like the last tooth in an old neighborhood's mouth. My, you have a way with words. You want to grab lunch first? Sure, I'll need my strength. I'll meet you back here at noon. I went back to my office and sat at my desk, thinking. I was not a native Philadelphian, although I had lived and worked in or around the city for more than a decade. I wasn't intimately familiar with the histories of the individual neighborhoods, though I could give a pretty fair summary of the history of the city in its earliest years. But for the 20th century and the early 21st century, I had little to offer. I knew vaguely that some areas had once been home to prosperous industries, and that their workers had lived nearby. I also knew that such neighborhoods, in Philadelphia and many other major cities, had their own life cycles, that the industries had become obsolete and closed, or had migrated to the suburbs during the last century, leaving behind neighborhoods that had declined slowly and inexorably. I had a feeling I was going to see one of those today. I grabbed a couple of books about Philadelphia history from my shelves. Leafing through them, I found a useful list of major manufacturing establishments in the early 20th century. I was surprised to see that sugar refining topped the list by a wide margin, until I remembered that the Jack Frost refinery had once occupied a substantial piece of land just the other side of the Schuylkill River. Now long gone, if I recalled correctly, it had been shut down in the 1980s. Iron and steel mills ranked next, also gone. The rest of the list made interesting reading. It included paper, leather and textile makers, meatpacking, ice cream. That made me smile, because Breyer's Ice Cream had been founded in Philadelphia right after the Civil War and was still making ice cream products. The city's northeast district had consistently been one of the most populous since the 19th century. I felt mildly embarrassed as I read along. I knew about the early settlement of the city, along the waterfront, and its gradual migration inland as the city grew, but much of my knowledge ended with the construction of City Hall, finished in 1901, which was kind of hard to miss. I had never had much cause to pay attention to the rise of industries and their shifting distribution, and had given little thought to the impact those changes on the inhabitants of various parts of the city. Did that make me a snob, concerned only with the rich and important citizens and what buildings and artifacts they'd left behind? It seemed that I was not doing my job, or not all of it. Shelby and I went out and grabbed a quick sandwich, and then returned to our respective desks. I did a little more reading, so at least I could ask the right questions during our excursion. At 2:05, I was waiting in the lobby for my zealous escorts. Chapter 3. Tyrone and Charisse arrived in a nondescript four-door sedan that had seen better days. I wondered if that was a reflection of their modesty, or recognition that we were headed for a neighborhood that would welcome a high-end car for all the wrong reasons, like seeing it as a source of spare parts. North Philadelphia begins only a few blocks north of Market Street, which runs east to west and extends for miles. This I knew from looking at maps and reading the papers. I couldn't recall that I'd ever set foot in any part of it, unless I was with someone who was most likely lost. It could be Mars for all its kinship to Center City. It is a slum, a ghetto, a blot on the city. Once upon a time, long, long ago, it had been a prosperous family neighborhood, full of tidy row houses that housed working-class people, and neighborhoods revolved around the factories, the churches, the union halls, the front stoops, and for some, the bars. Now, after the early families had fled to the suburbs, the factories had moved to China, and poorer minorities had moved in. It was known as the Badlands, or Killadelphia. Those guys we passed, standing on street corners, were drug dealers, and they weren't hiding it. Much of the time, the cops were part of the problem rather than the solution. Not only was there widespread corruption, but I'd read very recently that the U.S. Justice Department had reviewed shootings by cops in the city and found that while New York's population and police force were each 5 times larger than Philadelphia's, Philadelphia had far more police shootings. And the society owned a property smack in the middle of it. I was ashamed, and I had to do something about it. "Is it far?" I asked Tyrone, who was driving.
"Closer than you might think. You didn't find anything in your records?"
"Not yet. I have my director of development looking into it, but I didn't have much to work with. What is it you want me to look at here?" "Apart from the poverty and crime and depressing ugliness." "What do you know about Row House history?" Charisse asked, turning in her seat to face me. "Less than I should, I'm sure. What can you tell me?"
"Short version,"
Charisse asked. I nodded. Row houses were built to accommodate a growing artisan and commercial population. You could call them early middle class, she began. They were built quickly, which is not the same as badly, and often left unfinished so that the purchasers could add their own details. There were also a lot of row houses built as rentals, and they tended to be plainer. Usually 3 rooms deep, but narrow, with a small yard behind and an alley at the back between the rows. Front room was fancier, and that's where the heat was. Dining room and kitchen behind. The kitchen was usually pretty small, more an L than a room, or even in the basement sometime. Upstairs, 2 bedrooms in the front, either side of the staircase, and a bathroom at the back over the kitchen. That pretty much sums it up. That's what you've got.
I see. I did, but I saw much more. I saw streets where vacant lots alternated with abandoned buildings interspersed with a few houses that looked like someone was living or squatting in them. People hanging around, watching any car that passed with suspicion. Trashed cars parked at clumsy angles to the sidewalks. A few scraggly trees, usually at the back of the properties, where they'd sprung up untended. It was possible to see that these houses had once been nice, or at least respectable, but not anymore. Can you answer something honestly for me? Are you taking me along the worst possible route, or is this actually typical?
The two in the front seat exchanged glances. Half and half, Charisse answered. I know it's going to sound racist, or maybe I mean elitist, but you people in your nice, pretty antique buildings or your shiny glass skyscrapers in Center City really need to get out and see the real world now and then. This is it, and it's not pretty.
Was she trying to annoy me?
Point taken, I get it. So where's our house?
Next block over,
Tyrone said, and we all fell silent for the remaining short distance. He pulled up at the curb in front of the house, its number painted roughly on the stucco front. An orange sign tacked to the door said the building was condemned. The houses on either side were long gone, their lots now grassed over. At least there were some mature trees behind the building, providing a small amount of softness. The only window on the ground floor was covered with plywood, but in the upstairs windows, tattered lace curtains fluttered, which made me sad. Someone had once lived here, cared for the place. Now it was an eyesore, unsafe, and about to be destroyed. And it belonged to the society. I wasn't sure yet when the society had come into possession of it, but I thought it was a safe bet that nobody had been collecting rent or paying taxes on it for a long time. It had truly fallen off the map for both the society and the city.
This is kind of far gone to save, you said?
I noticed that neither of my companions had made a move to get out of the car.
Tyrone turned in his seat.
To be honest, yes. We weren't exactly pitching it to you that we could save the building. That's why we're calling it a funeral.
He made air quotes.
But we wanted to make a point. Obviously, this building has been neglected for years. The houses that stood next to it have long since fallen down or been razed. I could tell you who owned them years ago, but those people are either dead or untraceable. You and your society were easy to find once we located the record. I wanted you to see firsthand what neglect and abandonment can do. Not just to one building, but to the whole neighborhood. You can multiply what you see here over many, many city blocks in any direction from here.
Gee, thanks for the guilt trip, Tyrone. What do you want me to do? Apologize? I didn't know. Back when the society divested itself of what it thought was all its real estate, conditions were very different, and the properties were at least livable. I agree that this is tragic on many levels, but I'm not sure what you expect from me. You want me to step up and do public penance in the papers and the media? I was really getting upset, although I wasn't quite sure why. Maybe I was mad at myself. I'd made a point of avoiding looking at scenes like this, not only because they were dangerous, but because they were damn depressing. They certainly clashed with the calm and dignity of the society and what went on within its walls, where I was privileged to spend my time. This was as much a part of the city as the society's environs. Charisse had been quiet for a few minutes, letting Tyrone carry the ball, but now she nudged him. Tyrone, that car's driven past us before. She nodded toward a nondescript dark sedan coming toward us, moving slowly. Tyrone and Charisse exchanged looks again. What? I demanded. They were making me nervous. I glanced around the street. The nearest corner was maybe 100 feet away, ahead of us. There were few people on the street, none on this block, and I could count only a few parked cars in the distance. Okay, so a car circling the block at this particular location was suspicious. I got that.
I think we've seen enough,
Tyrone said, and turned the key to start the engine. Not quickly enough. I could see the same car rounding the corner ahead of us again. Then, like a bull in a ring, it accelerated rapidly toward us. Its windows rolled down, and a hand with a weapon emerged from the back seat. For a second I froze. Could this really be happening? But then I realized we were all like goldfish in a bowl, targets for whoever it was. The only thing I could hope to do was to get myself out of the line of fire, let Tyrone and Charisse fend for themselves. I ducked, quickly opened the door on the curbside, and rolled out and lay flat on what was left of the pavement, just as the first bullets hit the car, and continued to hit it, sending window glass spraying, thunking against metal, until I estimated any and all magazines had been emptied, I hoped. If someone got out of that car to check, I had nowhere to go. Luckily, the shooters seemed satisfied, because they revved their engine and sped off down the block, tires squealing, leaving heavy silence behind. I lay there for a moment, taking stock. I couldn't see anyone up or down the street, much less a concerned citizen who would already be calling the police. I wasn't hurt. Lying flat on my face had been a smart move, although I didn't recall thinking, only acting. I rose to my knees and peered into the front seat. Windshield reduced to shards, blood everywhere. Tyrone seemed to be moving, but Charisse was ominously still. I crawled over to the open rear door I'd thrown myself out, retrieved my purse, found my cell phone, and punched in 911. When someone answered, I said in a voice that was surprisingly calm, "There's been a shooting at 387 Bickley Street. 2 wounded, 1 possibly dead. The shooters are gone." Although they could come back. The dispatcher on the other end made soothing noises and told me to repeat the information, which I did. Cool under pressure, that was me. No problem, although I noticed as if from a distance that my hands were shaking, and I wasn't sure I could hit a phone button. She promised she was sending someone. She asked me to stay on the line. I hung up on her and hit James's speed dial.
"No?"
he answered in a cheerful voice.
"What's up?"
It took me a moment to string words together. "There's been a shooting. I'm kind of on the scene." James's next words could have come from a different person as he snapped into official mode.
"Are you hurt?"
"No, but the other people in the car are."
"Have you called the police?"
"Yes."
"Where are you?"
I gave him the address.
"I'll be there in 10. Rough neighborhood. If you have to move, let me know."
He hung up. I slumped back against the car after looking both ways. Still nobody in sight who seemed to care. Apparently random shootings were the norm here. Was I supposed to attempt first aid on Tyrone and Charisse? Not one of my strengths. Besides which, I was pretty sure that Charisse was beyond help. "Nell, what about Tyrone?" my inner conscience demanded. I wanted to tell her to shut up, but then I considered how I would feel if Tyrone bled to death within a couple of feet of me while I cowered on the pavement. I'd have to live with that. I didn't want to. I hauled myself to my feet and glanced around again, then came around to the driver's side and opened the front door. Tyrone was held in by his seatbelt, but he seemed to be bleeding from more than one place. When I touched his neck, feeling for a pulse, his eyes opened and focused on me.
"What the hell?"
Then he appeared to remember where he was, and he turned quickly, wincing, to Charisse.
"Damn,"
he whispered, then reached out and brushed a lock of hair from her face. His hand lingered on her cheek for a moment before he turned back to me.
"You call the police?"
He hadn't asked whether I was all right, but the fact that I was standing in front of him with no blood on me was probably enough. "Yes, and the FBI." Tyrone raised one eyebrow, so I explained, "My boyfriend's an agent." Tyrone leaned back and shut his eyes.
"Boyfriend'll probably be here before the cops."
The blood on his clothes kept spreading slowly, but at least there was no spurting. I had no idea what I could do to help. I was more likely to do harm than good. It seemed like an eternity, but was probably no more than 5 minutes before a black and white and James arrived at the same time. The cops looked wary, peering in all directions, hands on their weapons, as they approached.
"Are you the one who called in the shooting?"
one asked. I nodded and gestured toward the front seat. "No ambulance?" I asked in a hoarse croak.
"Sorry, we get a lot of false alarms in this neighborhood. Sometimes they just want to draw us in and take pot shots at us. We'll call for one now. You okay?"
I nodded. I wasn't hit. Just them.
"You in the car with them?"
"Yes, in the back seat. I saw a car approach slowly, and then I saw the gun. I ducked."
"Did you see the shooter?"
"One guy in the back seat, plus the driver. I don't think I'd recognize him. I was too busy ducking." And then James was there, wrapping me in his arms and pulling me close, and I burst into tears.
Excuse me, sir,"
one of the cops began. And without letting me go, James flashed his badge. The cop retreated. I tried to burrow into James's chest. I didn't want to open my eyes. Or maybe I did, because with my eyes closed, I kept seeing the same scene of car and guns over and over.
"You're not hurt?"
James's voice rumbled through his chest. I shook my head.
"But you saw what happened."
I nodded. "Part of it," I mumbled. I kind of got out of the way before the shooting started."
"Smart woman,"
James said. I snorted. "If I was a smart woman, I wouldn't be here at all."
"Why are you here?"
he asked. "Long story. What happens now?" I pulled back maybe an inch, which kind of helped my breathing.
"The police will want to know what you saw. Are you up to it, or do you want to go home? I can stall them if you want."
I made a quick assessment. Part of me really, really wanted to go home and curl up with my ratty bathrobe and a fuzzy blanket and drink a large scotch or two, neat, with James's arms around me. The grown-up part of me vetoed that. I swabbed away tears with the back of my hand. I think I'd better get this over with now. I might forget something.
"I've got your back,"
James said.
"I'm going with you."
"Thank you." I had no idea what to do with my hands or any of the rest of me. I grabbed James's lapels and kind of tugged on them, assuring myself he was real, and then realized my hands were bloody from when I'd looked for Tyrone's pulse. "Oh, sorry." James didn't say anything, just pulled me closer again. I could hear the sound of an ambulance approaching, but I didn't think that would help Charisse. Chapter 4. James escorted me to his car and settled me in the front seat, treating me as though I would break if handled carelessly. Then he went over to talk to the two cops. They all nodded like bobblehead dolls, and then James came back to the car and settled at the wheel. Before he started the engine, he said,
"They're going to oversee the process here. The ambulance will take Blakeney and Chapman to the hospital, and then the forensic people will take a look at the scene. These guys will call it into headquarters, and we'll go over there now so you can give your story. All right?"
I nodded and swallowed. "Is she..." I couldn't bring myself to say it.
"I'm afraid so. Did you know her?"
I shook my head. "I only met them both this morning."
I'd ask you more questions, but I think it would be better if you only had to go through it once. You sure you're all right?
Physically? Sure, I guess. The rest of me is kind of numb. I laid a hand on his arm. Thank you for being here.
Nell, why wouldn't I be? I love you. I want to help. And if anyone comes down hard on you, I'll be all over them.
My knight in shining armor. I managed a weak smile. In a peculiar way, I feel responsible. If only someone had gotten the paperwork right a century ago, none of us would have been here this afternoon.
I don't begin to understand that statement, but let's save it until we get to the roundhouse.
He started the car and pulled away from the house. A few people had gathered on the nearest corner, keeping a wary eye on the flashing lights down the block. And they watched us drive by, their faces blank, their eyes cold. Philadelphia's police headquarters, often called the Roundhouse, was only a matter of blocks away, and I'd been known to walk there from the society. I wish I could say I didn't know the building fairly well, but somehow I kept ending up here. At least I hadn't been arrested yet, but I'd proved evidence for more than one homicide. No one had ever mentioned that working for a staid, non-profit organization could be dangerous. I was learning the hard way. James parked and handed me out of the car. I stood up and smoothed my clothes. There wasn't much I could do about the bloodstains. He took my arm and led me to the entrance, where he explained our presence to the gatekeeper while I stared blindly into space. 3 minutes later, my favorite—well, the only one I knew personally, thank goodness—homicide detective emerged from an elevator. "I can't believe it's you two again. Can't stay out of trouble, eh?" Detective Meredith Hrivenek greeted us. Then she noted the blood and our grim expressions. She actually was a pretty good detective, and escorted us through the entry procedure, alerting the desk to James's weapon. She remained silent as we took the elevator up to her floor, and she led us to an interview room. "You want coffee? Something else?" I was about to decline when James nodded.
"Coffee for her. With sugar. Thanks."
She hesitated a moment, then nodded and went off to get it. "Standard treatment for shock?" I asked.
"It helps. It also helps to have something to hold on to and to do something that requires some coordination, like swallowing. Trust me."
I clasped his hand under the table. "I do. Are you just going to observe?"
"Yes. I wasn't there, and I don't know what happened. I'm strictly here for your sake, not in any official capacity. And I think Hrivenek plays fair, so she's not going to badger you. Just tell her what you saw."
"That I can do." We lapsed into silence again, James's hand warm in mine, until Hrivenek returned with coffee in a foam cup. I took it and sipped. It tasted of sugar more than anything else, but at least it was hot. James was right. Having to focus on getting it to my mouth and down my throat helped, in a weird way. Detective Hrivenek took a chair opposite the two of us and looked us over. "Okay. I got the preliminary details from the street cops. Bad neighborhood, drive-by shooting, one dead, one wounded. And you? What the hell were you doing in the middle of it, Nell Pratt?"
I sat up straighter in my chair. "This morning, Charisse Chapman and Tyrone Blakeney came to my office to tell me that the society owned the property where the shooting took place. I didn't know, because I thought we had disposed of all real estate decades ago. But apparently the paperwork got messed up on this one."
"So you had to go running over to look at it?"
"Not exactly. Normally I would have called our attorney and let her handle it. But Mr. Blakeney and Ms. Chapman wanted something more. Apparently they are, or were, both involved in some kind of neighborhood rescue program to reclaim dying neighborhoods. And once they discovered the society's connection, they thought maybe we could be useful to that effort. We didn't have time to get into the details, but the fact that we owned a piece of it gave us a reason to get involved, at least in their eyes. Of course, I told them that it wasn't my decision to make, that the board would have to be involved in anything like that, and that would take time. They were impatient, since I gather that house is scheduled to be demolished shortly, and they asked me if I wanted to see it to get a sense of what they were talking about, since I don't know that neighborhood well. I agreed. It seemed fair. They picked me up and drove me over it, too."
"Why am I not surprised that you don't know that lovely neighborhood?"
It was a snide comment, and I didn't know what to say, so I settled for saying nothing.
Okay, then what happened?
Hrivenek resumed her formal interrogation. We drove over to the house and parked. Tyrone and Charisse didn't seem eager to get out of the car. I didn't see anybody around, or at least not very close. Then Charisse noticed a car that had driven past before. It drove past us slowly, that was the second time, and then went around the block. The next time they went by, the guy in the back seat of the car started shooting.
James's hand tightened on mine.
How many shooters?
Hrivenek barked. Just the one, in the back seat.
Weapons?
Hard to tell. It happened so fast, and I don't usually see them from the barrel end. It wasn't a rifle or an Uzi, but it looked pretty big to me.
How many shots?
Lots. More than enough. The shooter kept on firing. I'd guess 15 rounds.
James and the detective exchanged a glance, but I wasn't about to explain why I knew that.
Blakeney and Chapman were both hit multiple times. Why'd they miss you?
Because I threw myself out of the car onto the pavement and waited until the shooting stopped. Either they didn't notice me or they didn't care.
Then what?
I waited to see if they were going to get out of the car or come back. They sped off. I don't know which way they went. When I thought it was safe, I got up and checked on the others. I was pretty sure that Charisse was gone, but Tyrone was conscious. Then I called 911. And James.
Describe the car the shooters were driving.
I did, to the best of my ability. I'm not a car person, so I couldn't give more than general details. Dark, oldish, no distinguishing marks that I could remember. Of course, I hadn't thought to look at the license plate. And then I remembered that Pennsylvania didn't even require front plates, so I couldn't have seen it anyway.
The guys in the car, black, white, something else?
Hrivenek asked. I think black. Not kids, maybe in their 30s. Male. They were wearing something with long sleeves, maybe sweatshirts, but I couldn't tell you what color. Not pink or yellow, at least. If they had tattoos, I couldn't tell. I really only glanced at them when Charisse first pointed them out. After that, all I saw was the gun.
So you didn't recognize them?
No. As I said, I've never been in that neighborhood before.
You think they recognized Blakeney, or the woman?
You think one of them was the target? I countered.
Too soon to tell.
Do you know anything more about them, beyond what they told me? I asked.
Chapman was a city employee and L&I. Blakeney was part of a non-profit community redevelopment organization that's been working to save neighborhoods around the city, just like you said. The two of them worked together. The city knew that Chapman was doing it, part of some city-sponsored program, even got some good PR about it. Made them look like they cared.
That fit. I can't see why anybody would want to hurt them. Weren't they trying to do something good?
As far as we know, but it's early days. We'll be checking into their backgrounds now. Based on what you've told us, this doesn't sound like a random drive-by. Not if they scouted you out first. They didn't say anything?
Not that I recall.
Question is, did they see you?
I felt a chill. I'm not sure. Again, as I said, I got out of the car and hid, and they didn't come back after me. So either I didn't matter if they had a plan or they didn't see me. I'm pretty sure it's the first. They didn't know me, they had no reason to know who I was or why I was there, and it wasn't worth eliminating me.
You want to look at mugshots? Try a sketch artist?
I shook my head. I don't think I saw enough. Maybe if I saw the driver again I'd know him, but I doubt it.
Would he know you?
Hrivenek said, surprisingly quietly. Now my stomach was churning.
I don't know. You think he'd come after me?
If he knew Blakeney or Chapman, maybe he worked with one of them. He could find out who you are. You kind of stick out in that neighborhood. He doesn't know that you didn't see squat.
Maybe I should try to convince myself that it really had been a random drive-by. No, that wasn't working. What am I supposed to do about that?
First, give us some time to do our jobs. Second, watch your back. Third, you've got him.
She nodded toward James.
To cover you at home, right?
I wondered how she knew that. How long is this going to go on?
Till we catch the guys.
And if you don't? Philadelphia Homicide did a fair job of clearing cases, but this one didn't offer much to work with.
Hrivenek looked at me directly, her expression serious.
You know I can't answer that, and I won't sugarcoat it. We'll do our best.
She stood up.
I think that's enough for now. You can come back and sign your statement tomorrow.